Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Well, today, folks, I've got a fantastic guest. I've known him quite a long time. In fact, it's as long as he has been successfully qualifying to race at the Ironman World Championships in Kona. So welcome to the show first, Owen Martin, all the way from Ireland.
Hey, Simon. Thanks very much for having me on.
Which part of Ireland are you in, Owen?
I live County Armagh. Newry, I suppose, would be the nearest city to me.
Okay. Are you in the country there or are you based in a town?
I live in the country.
Okay. So I'm just thinking about opportunities for things like swimming. You know, I know how difficult it is around in Yorkshire if you're not near somewhere with a decent pool.
No. I'm blessed with the Spike Studio I own. Actually has a 25-meter pool right below it, and the other pool access to swimming pools for me is really, really easy.
Perfect. Well, we're going to come on to chat about your training history and your success in Kona and all of that other stuff a bit later on, Owen. But I've started recently, as all good coaches should, before you get onto the main set, having a little bit of a warm-up for everybody before we go. So I've got some questions for you here. I did want to ask you what your dream job is. And if you say you've got a bike studio, is that what you do, bike fit or bike spinning classes?
Yeah. I wouldn't actually say it was bike spinning, but it's a bike studio, yeah. And it's sort of an extension to the coaching and stuff I do. So, yeah, it's a bike spinning studio, not like your normal spinning studio, though.
Do you have turbo trainers there set up then with bikes?
We use the Techno Gym bikes.
Okay. And what sort of things do you do with the clients when they come in then?
Generally what we do with them, Simon, is it's not completely necessary, but it definitely gives the experience a whole lot more of a better feel. We actually have a watt bike and we test them to set the heart rate zones and then there's an app, a My Wellness app. We get the heart rate zones imported to that. When they enter the studio, it's a really simple process. There's a barcode on the bike, the scan in, all of their information is linked to the bike. And then the big screen we have at the top of the studio, if your bike number six will appear on the screen, and your whatever metric the instructor chooses in terms of wattage, watts per kilo, heart rate, power, this, all loads and loads of metrics. We base the classes around that, very structured classes, not the normal gym bunny spin classes you would see online and stuff.
Cool. And popular then? Do you run a lot of classes every day?
Yeah, we do. At this time of year, we run anything from 3 to 5 classes per day.
Mm. Yeah. Typical January upsurge in people wanting to get fit. And as we were talking about before we started recording, probably a little bit of a drop off around the mid-February, do you, as the motivation wanes? And
no, not February. Oh. No, we were lucky. We continued from December, January, February, March. We continued being quite busy really up until May, until almost the triathlon season started, even though not all of our clients are actually triathletes. But no, we didn't see a drop off until late May, which was good for us.
You and I met as a result of your use of a product called CompuTrainer, which is an indoor bike training tool, and I was the UK distributor. And one of the things that I used to find was that a lot of people would use a CompuTrainer religiously through the winter, which seems like an obvious choice. But then they would stop doing that and they would go outside and ride outdoors in the summer, which on the face of it, you know, is what you're aiming for, isn't it? Riding strong in the nice weather outside. But one thing I also used to observe was that a lot of people had a decline in fitness when they were no longer doing the controlled indoor sessions. When they were just riding outdoors, they perhaps didn't ride as hard. They didn't do the hard efforts for long enough. And because obviously, you know, just conditions, road conditions, traffic lights, that, you know, tailwind, topography, those sort of things got in the way. Do you find the same?
I agree with you 100%. There's no really, you can't really be as specific with your sessions. The really, really super important sessions outdoors as you can be indoors. Just as you said, you know, within traffic lights, potholes, traffic, all bits and pieces. If you're on your turbo trainer, get on, do it, and you can be specific to the last watt, I suppose, in terms of duration, in terms of recovery, in terms of efforts. Yeah, for me, for many, many, many years now, I've done even the majority of all my important stuff indoors.
Yeah, and of course, when you go in full gas, you know, and you started to see some red mist and a few stars, the last thing you want to do is be trying to work out what that car's going to be doing ahead of you, isn't it, or avoiding the potholes.
Absolutely.
So as I said, I was going to ask you about your dream job, Owen, but I would guess that you're probably in that. But so I thought I might change it a little bit. You've competed at the highest level as an age group triathlete. You know, did it ever cross your mind that it might have been a nice life to be a professional triathlete, or do you feel in where you are now that you've got the best of both worlds?
No, I feel now where I even from when I was younger, like say even 5 or 6 years ago, and people would say to me, do you not wish that you had been or even tried to be a professional triathlete? I would say 30% of me said yes, the rest said no. For me, even say, number one, if I had been professional, I wouldn't have been at a standard that would have been like a really good professional. I would have been mid-pack professional or something like that. And seeing some of the professionals, their lifestyles and their, for me, they don't really have a good life. You know, racing is all well and good, but your whole life just can't be racing. And you need some stability in your life. You need a home. You need some, all the normal stuff every person could have. So no, I'm the route I chose, I believe, was best for me.
I did a podcast with Elliot Smales the other day. Elliot's up and coming in this world. He's won a few 70.3 events, won the one in Dublin, actually. Fastest GB athlete to debut Ironman in just over 8 hours. But, you know, even the success he's had, and I mean, he's only 25 and he's just starting out on his pathway there, but even the success he's had, he's still sort of needed to win a race to tide him over for the winter with enough money to get to his first race. And there's still that pressure, you know, if he goes to a race and has a puncture, he doesn't finish. So then the pressure's on even more to earn money at the next race. And once the pressure's on, you tend to tighten up a bit, don't you? It's not an easy life. And I wouldn't like to think that, you know, I love riding my bike, I love swimming, I like running, but I wouldn't like to think that I had to do it. I like to do it because it's a choice.
Yeah. I think, not unless you're a Jan Frodeno or a Daniela Ryf or any of those like really top pros that we have in the circuit now, that those guys with sponsorship deals, like they're making a really, really good living, and that's fine. But the likes of the guy you just spoke about, who's only coming into the sport now, he's a young guy, it's difficult. It's really, really difficult. And to be chasing races to earn some money, number one, don't forget, all of these races that you're chasing takes a physical toll on your body as well. And at some point, we all break down. And when he breaks down, or if he breaks down, or people similar like him break down, that's your job. You're out of your job. Mm. So you have to be smart about it as well, I think.
I remember Richard Allen, who was based in the UK, in Leeds here. I remember seeing him when he started out as a 16, 17-year-old. Richard did pretty well. I think he won 9 British titles. He raced around the world. You know, he had a pretty successful career, but I remember him telling me about his life, you know, get on a plane on Wednesday, fly out to a race, arrive Thursday, do all his prep Friday, race Saturday, fly home on the Sunday, unpack his bag on the Monday, do some training on Tuesday and Wednesday, then off again, just a constant round of traveling, packing up bikes, in and out of hotels, no chance to ever see the venue that he was racing at, the beautiful locations, no chance to really hang out with any triathletes and have a beer after the race. You think they've all got the latest bikes and the latest kit, but often they're racing on stuff that's 2 or 3 years old. They're not really getting any cash from the sponsors. It's mostly equipment. So that means that they struggled to, you know, to pay the bills unless they're winning a race. It's the reality is, as you've described, it's not quite as glamorous as it looks.
No, it's not. It's you know, it's not that I'm dissing the pro life. I just think it's so hard. It's just not hard in terms. It's hard in terms of to have a proper life, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not. Several people asked me that if I'd ever have ever have turned pro? And my answer was an unequivocal no. You know, I think if you're able to work and do the races you want and enjoy the life, I think that's probably the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so you're quite an inspirational character, Owen, and I'm sure that you've inspired a lot of the triathletes and cyclists surrounding your area. Who are the people that have inspired you most and continue to inspire you now?
That's a good question. In terms of other athletes or other people, or
or a whole range.
I've never looked at people whenever I ask a question, who is your sports hero? And to me, even though I'm actually struggling now to think who I would extremely look up to, I don't really have any person like that. As you said, I'm just a normal Joe Bloggs, and I don't see myself as any super or great athlete or anything out there. I just like to get on with it. I don't look too much around me, who's doing this or who's doing that. You know, I don't have any favourite footballers. I don't have any, yes, I've favourite, you know, the Jan Verdinos and stuff like that, but you know, I look at that type of stuff, but I don't really pay much attention to it, I suppose.
You must have met a lot of the pros, because obviously you get on the podium and you tend to mix with them as you going up to the award ceremonies. You know, which of those stands out for you as the people that you feel are good role models, and sort of, because you know, they're professionals, but there's a whole range of them. You look at some people and think, I like the way he conducts himself, I like what he does, I love his philosophy and his training, and then there's somebody else and you think, no, I'm not sure about him. Mm-hmm. You know,
quite a few. I've met quite a few of them, and you know, one example is Jan Verdino. A few years back, myself and another friend of mine were just riding back in the Queen K from doing whatever session we were doing, and Jan was obviously finished his session, and the three of us just rode in together for the last 30-40 minutes, and there he was, the current world champion, chatting away to two age groupers, and he showed us as much respect as we showed to him. And to me, that was a great thing about the sport. Here I was cycling with the current world champion, and he was giving me as much respect as I was giving him. I know Rachel Joyce quite well. And, you know, I've met quite a few. And I honestly can't say any of the professionals I've ever met in Kona or elsewhere around the world, they've all had time for me, and they don't know me. And that's what I like about the sport. There's no guys walking around with their chest puffed out, and you know, in the right circumstances, they just have a coffee, they'll chat, you know, and that's probably one of the things I really like about our sport. You know, it is an elite sport, but there's people are generally really, really down to earth.
Jan's name comes up quite a lot when you talk to people who've met him and say, what a humble guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's one of my friends was showing him around you know, when you go into the racking area, you put your bike in on Friday in Kona, and you know I've done that job for the last couple of years, you know, as one of those guided escorts, so you take you around, show you where to hang your bags, and everybody, yourself included, will get one of those little, you know, when you go to get register, you get those bags, and there's a little bracelet in there that you can give out to a volunteer. Jan Frodeno gave it to my friend. He said, you thank you so much, you've been my volunteer of the weekend. They had a really good conversation the other day before a race that, you know, having had two disappointing years, he was coming back. There was a lot of pressure on him, and yet there he was chatting as if he was going for a swim in the sea.
Yeah, you know, lots of the stuff that you never see on the YouTube or the Ironman footage, like the year that Jan had that bad year when his back popped or whatever happened to him, I seen him walking down the Leahy Drive.
Yeah,
and he was encouraging, like, all of the pros were all ahead of him, or most of them were all ahead of him, and he spent most of his time clapping the age groupers. And even though he knew he was maybe not even going to finish the race, but he was still showing positivity. And you know, that's only one example. So Jan is only one example of many, many, many out there. You know, last year in Kona, I was just doing a session on the Queen K, and I didn't know Tim Reid personally. I knew him through a friend, and I was in a group of three other pros, three who I don't know. Tim, I did know, and they were just riding easy. I was just riding easy, and we just had a conversation. And the Queen Kate was great.
Yeah, great stuff. Let's say they decided to make a film of your life, Owen. You know, your amazing triathlon journey as an age grouper. who would you choose to be? Who would you choose to play your part?
I don't know his name, but you know the guy who was the policeman in Terminator.
Oh.
Two or three. The guy who was made of steel, him.
we'll have to do a little Google search on that one. But I'm not really policeman in Terminator 2. Robert Patrick. Oh yeah, yeah, I know the guy. The guy with the slick back hair.
Yeah.
There you go, Robert Patrick. Is that your favourite film then, Owen? Terminator.
Not really. It's just there was one of my friends many years ago compared me to him because in the Terminator films he just keeps going and going and going and going. So that's the only thing that popped. Random question and a random answer.
No, that's good. Yeah, the Terminator. Didn't they used to call Scott Molina the Terminator?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
I think. And I think that was down to one day they were out on a training ride and a squirrel or a rabbit ran across the road, went straight in between the wheels of his bike, and the spokes sort of shredded the rabbit. And so all of his friends called him the Terminator after that. So, yours is probably a better a better story. Do you, if you had a superpower, what would it be?
What would my superpower be? Don't know. The first thing that actually sprung to my mind was be invisible.
Yeah.
Don't know why. You know, I may as well give an honest answer. That's the very first thing that sprung to my mind. So to be invisible.
To be invisible so that they don't see you coming. Hey?
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
I always think when I fly out to Kona every year and get back that if I had one superpower, it would be the ability to teleport myself from one venue to another without all of that horrible travel stuff.
I think Kona is probably one of the only places that I wish that could happen. Was, you know, going out to Kona is never so bad, but coming home, it's that airport post-race, it's a difficult place to be.
Well, and then getting to LA at 5 a.m, not having any sleep, hanging around for a few hours, then you've just got to schlep back to the UK. You know, it's a 10-hour flight. You get back, you've got that horrible jet lag for a week. I've been stood in a few airports in the last few months, and it just seems like it's such a chore now to queue up to register or to check in, to queue up to get on the plane, you know, to queue up for customs. It's So if I could avoid all of that and just jump in a little time machine and just get out the other end.
Yeah, I know.
I think that might be the superpower I had. Do you read much, Owen? Do you get much chance to read? You sound like a
not
busy
really.
Man.
Yeah, no, it's not that I'm busy. I just find reading very, very tiring. I do read, but I don't read lots and lots of books. The last book I probably read from start to end, and was the Tyler Hamilton book. Do you know? I forget the name of it, but the book by Tyler Hamilton. It was just one of those books where I started to read. And generally, I put a book down after 2 or 3 chapters if I don't find it interesting. But I read it from start to end. And then another one that I don't read from cover to cover every now and again. I just read chapter to chapter because it's really a book of, I suppose, different stories. Is How Bad Do You Want It? I think is it Matt Fitzgerald's book?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, How Bad Do You Want It? So that's what another one I read recent enough that I could continually go to read. I don't read all that much. I like to go online, research stuff, but books, no.
The Secret Race was that Tyler Hamilton book. I've just remembered that.
Yeah, Secret Race.
And I read that one when it first came out. Loved that book. Loved it.
Yeah, it was good. It was very, very good.
All of the insights into the behavior of Ferrari as well. You know, Tyler, 6.7 watts per kilo. 6.7. Drink water.
It was crazy stuff. Crazy.
Yeah, there's obviously quite a few people have said to me now that they use Audible, particularly when they've got those long turbo sessions and they listen to books, particularly like Stephen Seiler was saying in his podcast that he's just got into Audible, and when he's doing his easy sessions, you know, his zone one sessions, he likes nothing better than to just plug in a book and ride for a couple of hours and just keep his heart rate in check. And he said, I know when I'm going too hard, when I stop being able to hear the words on the book. So that's
it's something that even on, if I'm doing an easy turbo, I tend not to, I maybe have music on, but if I'm using, I use Zwift, and I just tend to focus on, even though you're looking at numbers and not really paying attention to them, it's just something I don't tend to be able to focus so much on listening. I've never actually watched the movie once whilst doing a long turbo.
Well, it always amazes me that people can watch movies while they're doing that stuff. I mean, I always think that that's a way of distracting yourself, a bit like wearing headphones when you're running. And but I know from using my Compu Trainer that there are times when you can't actually hear the words on the screen. So you have to rewind the video a little bit to hear what was said. And then when you're doing that, you forget what you're doing on the bike, your heart rate drops or your power goes up. So it always feels like you wouldn't be able to adequately watch the film and no. You wouldn't be adequately able to do the training session. So they're both getting compromised. So why bother?
No, I agree. It's something I heard years and years and years ago. I did try, and it just for the reasons that you just said, I couldn't hear what the movie was saying, and I kept rewinding. You know, you're on your turbo or your WAP bike or whatever you're using. You know, get the work done and get it done properly.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I have started listening to some podcasts, but even then, you know, if I'm listening to somebody who's sort of relating a story about training performance or data or something where I'd like to pick up the information and sort of store it away for future reference, I find myself having to make notes, you know, mental notes, or I find myself having to stop and type something into my phone. And then I thought, no, this is distracting me now. So I just tend to put on some light music and let it bumble away in the background. But really, I'm like you, I'm focusing on my pedal cadence, focusing on the thing, and just it's 90 minutes, isn't it? It's not that long.
No.
I know you've just been to Cozumel, haven't you? And before that, you were in Kona. So some people would say those would be exotic holiday destinations. Where's the favourite place you've been to? And if you were going to choose one place to base yourself for the rest of your life, for you, just for holidays, where would you go if you could only ever go there again?
Probably somewhere in Europe. Somewhere that's easy. I go to Lanzarote for training whenever I can. So I like it there. I wouldn't like to live there permanently. So Lanzarote for me is my favorite training location. I've been in mainland Spain, the likes of even Marbella and that. Even there's some fantastic bike routes and that around there. I actually got married at Lake Como in Italy. It's beautiful there. You know, so yeah, I don't think I would ever base myself in one location, but there's other locations. You know, Europe in general, you know, you have a countless countries that offers really everything.
We cycled as a group of friends. We cycled from Austria down to Lake Como. That was our finishing spot in Como at the end of the lake, and we cycled all down the west side. Some beautiful little villages. But what one thing that struck me about Como, maybe it was just because we were around the town there, was that the lake seemed pretty dirty. We ended up in Bellagio as well, and even up there the lake seemed dirty. We then went to Lake Garda, and that was totally different. It was just exactly what you'd imagine of a lake.
Yeah, I agree. So Bellagio is where I got married, and before, this is many moons ago, the wedding and even after the wedding stuff, I swam in that lake, and you're right, it was horrible to swim in. So it was.
We'd all, as we were riding down, and we had cycled through the Dolomites and the Italian Alps in that had a really heavy duty heat wave there all the time we were cycling, and it was, you know, touching 40 degrees most days. Even on the top of the Stelvio, I think it was 30 degrees when we got up there, which is unheard of. Yeah. And so on that final day, or, you know, we had about 60 miles to do. It was pretty flat riding around the lake. And all we could think of was, right, as soon as we get to the hotel, check in, I'm going to run over the road. I'm going to dive in that lake. I'm going to spend half an hour cooling off. Where we were, there was lots of all the ferry boats and everything was there. So we had to walk around the edge of the lake for a sort of half a mile. We found some steps to get in. All it was Coke cans, bottles, you know, bits of sort of just detritus and stuff like you might see in a harbour.
Yeah.
All we could do was get in, have a little bit of a dip and get out again. It was just that filthy. It was very disappointing.
Yeah.
I know you've got a coach who we've talked about and we'll talk about in a moment, but let's say you could choose somebody to mentor you either in your life or your business or for you know, to help you develop your coaching, is there any one person you could pick out who you would think, right, I'd like to spend a month in their shoes learning how they live their life?
I sort of like Sanders' approach to stuff. I would like to spend a month with him.
Oh, Lyle Sanders.
I find him a very intriguing and interesting guy.
Yes,
I've never met him, even Kona, and that. I like watching his YouTube channel and stuff, and his more so from his mental approach to his training. Now, I know he's got it wrong quite a few times and stuff, but I just find the way his brain works quite interesting. In some ways, very similar to the way I approach things. And I'm not comparing myself to him, but I find him a really intriguing guy in terms of the way he analyzes stuff and he approaches stuff. And I just, yeah, I would like to spend a month with that guy. And I believe he's very mentally strong. And again, you know, yeah, I find him just a cool type of guy, I suppose.
Well, he's got a massive following, hasn't he? I think probably because he puts it all out there. You know, he doesn't keep anything quiet. No. He doesn't have any secrets. He's quite happy to talk about his mistakes and his errors, and almost too much at times. You know, and too much. You know, you see him sitting there on his lanai the day after Kona, sort of. He's already gone into you almost feel like he spent all night awake thinking about what went wrong and where he can go better next time.
That I suppose is how I relate myself to him. Again, I do similar things, and even in my own training, like you just said, he puts it all out there. There is no secrets, and you know, and I know there is no secrets to be successful in our sport.
I like that answer. Actually, quite a few of our recent guests have talked about business people they wanted to be, they wanted to mentor. I think one guy mentioned a fellow called Jack Ma, who owns Alibaba, which is that Chinese commerce site. So it's quite interesting. But I like your line of thinking there, Lionel Sanders, just to get into his head and see what he does when he's not on YouTube, how much time he spends planning those videos, or whether it's all just off the cuff. Find out what involvement his wife has in there, because all she seems to do is hold the camera for him. okay, let's get chatting about your triathlon then, Owen, because I know that's what people are really keen to do. I mentioned earlier that you have just come back from Cozumel. You won your age group. You secured another Kona spot for 2020. Can you talk about the race a little bit there? Cozumel's one of the places I've not been to.
Yeah, Cozumel for me now is my favourite race location by far. It was just and not because I went and not because I had a good race. I went there not knowing how I would perform. I was a little bit stressed about going because I heard some people who had given me information about the journey there, and it seemed a little bit complicated. It actually wasn't complicated at all. Getting the ferry from Cancun over to Cozumel was a mini adventure in itself. It was just spectacular and beautiful. It was a really cool race. Really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the island. The people were extremely friendly. The roads, well, the island's not that big for starters. In terms of cycling safety, when you arrive there to do whatever bits of training you have to do, there was a road, the old road that just goes the whole way around the island, that is next to the road that you race on race day, and is for most part closed to traffic. So I really enjoyed that. The weather was, again, it's almost a Kona. Well, it is a Kona picture. Blue skies, hot, humid. We didn't get so much wind on race day until later on the bike. But it was a spectacular place. Definitely, I'm really, really happy I made the decision to go there. Now, definitely am.
You mentioned Kona there. You raced in Kona. How was your race there this year? Because when I was looking at the result, it would be probably not what I would expect from you.
No, the race didn't go exactly to plan. But I think last year was my 10th year racing, and I've learned certainly this last 3 to 4 years, you can be as fit, you can be the fittest man in the world, you can be. I've trained perfectly. Everything kind of gone. Kona is for me, is without a doubt, and people say it quite often, it's a magical place. I fully, fully believe that. It's a very mysterious place. The strongest people crack. You know, even if you look at even the top pros, how most of them end up walking most of the marathon. And those are the fittest and fastest guys in our sport. For me this year, didn't go exactly the plan. I was very well prepared in terms of fitness, in terms of training. Couldn't really went much better. Again, with me going back to what we just mentioned a few moments ago, not that I overthink stuff, but I'm very much a perfectionist, and maybe that's really, really good. Maybe it's not so good at times either. And I tried to fix a problem that didn't really exist last year in Kona. So going back to the year before, I actually raced quite well. Everybody had a fast time that year, but I had a nice fast time. I had no difficulty at all. I went to Kona this year with expectations of, with my ability, I could finish definitely in the top five of my age group. Going by looking who, well, who would potentially be there and what I was doing and training and stuff. And anyway, the short answer is that I took in too much sodium on the bike. And when it came to the run, almost from the start, even though I got enough fluids in, I overdosed really on sodium, and my gut was I was taking in the fluids okay, but it was just going nowhere. I was getting severe tummy cramps right from the start, and it wasn't really until the last 8 mile or so where I had to walk quite a bit because I was getting really bad cramps. But at that, I accepted it. You know, I wasn't disappointed. I wasn't, this is a bad race, and feeling sorry for myself, because at that, I accepted. I was extremely lucky to be there. I was extremely blessed to be there. I just looked to my right. I was looking over the bay. The sun was getting lower in the sky, and I did nothing but smile. I was not disappointed in any shape or form. And I was lucky enough that it nearly almost went away for the last 2K, and I got to run the last 2K almost normally. And you know the finish line down Palani. I enjoyed it. It was good. I got to run across the finish line. The family were there. So it was good. It was a positive race for me. Not the result I wanted, but I certainly, when I crossed the finish line, I didn't put my hands and then go, no. I was happy. I was delighted. And that's just Ironman racing. It doesn't go away all the time. It's impossible to go away all the time. And I was good with it.
I think that sort of pragmatism about your performance comes with age and experience, doesn't it? And particularly in Kona, there's not many people that are going to have their best race out there just because the conditions are so much different to what most people have dealt with. And I do wonder, you know, because the pros talk about this occasionally, you see people who dominate events elsewhere. And I often think that's because they're in front and they're able to control their effort and everything else. But when you're in Kona, my observations from watching is the swim is like an ITU race. It goes ballistic. So if you're not a good swimmer, you're under the pump from the start and you're chasing. If you then come out of the water down on that lead pack, you are then chasing and pushing a power and an effort that you might not want to with a high heart rate. And in that heat and humidity, your temperature's already rising. And so you're cooked by the time you get to RV. That's it. And I guess it's probably the same for you guys at the front of your age groups, is it?
It's the exact same. For me, swimming is my weakest sport. Well, more so in Kona. I enjoy the swim, but at that, it's still pretty intense. It's pretty full on. And generally, I'm coming down 2 to 3 to 4, maybe 5 minutes on the really, really faster swimmers in my age group. And at that, I know I'm chasing. And so there's not really bike faster than me in the age group. And, you know, I'm biking hard, but I'm biking always in control. I've whatever numbers I have, I stick to. But yeah, that funny enough, last year was the first year it was a little bit better with the new swim star. It made things a bit better. But yeah, it's the same for age groupers as it is the pros. But look, stuff happens, you know, and that's just it. And if you put your head in your hands and go, well, that's not fair, it's not fair. Well, tough.
What did you think of that new swim star, Owen?
Before the race, I wasn't for it at all. Again, as I said, the swim part in the first 2, 3, or 4 years, it was intense. It was the most scary, horrible. It was just the most difficult thing I've ever done. But it was also exciting. So I wasn't really for it this year. But the short answer is it worked really, really well. It was good. This was the first year, last year was the first year when I got on the bike, almost from the start, heading up that Kuikini Highway. There was no packs, and you know what that is. And it was pretty spread out from then, but certainly when we got, even well before the airport, it was fine. Yes, there was the few who blatantly draft. I can't actually recall seeing one big group at all, whereas the last 2 to 3 years, it was pelotons. It was ridiculous. So for me, I'm a fan of it now. For the simple reason is it, without a doubt, made the bike fairer.
We talked about, you go to Kona, it's the middle of October. You've got a, I don't know, a full day of traveling effectively, and you don't sleep very much for, it's two nights, isn't it, by the time you've got across to the West Coast. You've set off from Kona in the evening, you've got across to the West Coast, then you've got another night to go through. So you're sort of pretty jet lagged. You've got an 11-hour time difference to make up by the time you get home. You're recovering from not sleeping much, and you've just done the biggest race of your season. So that's going to limit your ability to get back to training for at least a couple of weeks. No matter how fit and healthy you are, you're still a human being, and you've still got to get over those things. How do you get back into training for a race that's coming up at the beginning of December? Because that's only 6 weeks away, and then you've still got to do a lot more, another big long haul flight to get back across to Mexico.
Again, it all comes down to, I know that if I don't do it, when I go to Cozumel or Arizona or whatever race I choose to try and re-qualify, well, I won't get the result. So It's either put your head down, put all the negativity out of your head, go, oh, I'm tired from doing the Kona and this. Well, yes, I may be tired a little bit, but it's, if I want to do it, I have to do it. And that's it.
No, I get that. But I mean, at what point, you're not going to be able to get back to the level of fitness you had for Kona, are you? Surely?
No, never. So definitely numbers, in terms of CTLs and stuff like that, will never be as high. But the point I was making, you know, I may go to Kona extremely fit. This year I intend to do things a little bit different, but I've put all my eggs almost in the Kona basket this last 2 to 3 seasons. Numbers extremely high, fitness extremely high. But I've just felt as if I got to Kona, certainly the last 3 years, extremely fit, but just not race ready. And going back to the question, when I've raced Arizona those last couple of years, and then last year at Cozumel, I may not be as fit, but I'm very, very battle hardened. And I think that also plays a big, big point. Whereas I'm very familiar with the intensity of the swim. I'm very familiar with the fatigue on the bike, the soreness, the dehydration on the run. You know, it's just generally a hang in there type situation. But my mind and body is very familiar with it. And I'm able just to, well, this is normal, Owen. Get on with it. Keep running. There's nothing wrong. You're meant to be tired. You're meant to be sore. You're meant to be a bit sick. Just harden up and get on with it.
Well, I mean, what you're doing there in doing Kona and then doing another race fairly quickly on the back of that is what a lot of the pros are doing now, because it gives them then, you know, they take the break towards the end of the year around Christmas. That falls in quite nicely with the seasons. And then it gives them the whole year to base the training around Kona next year. I noticed this year quite a few pros, Cameron Wirth, Joe Skipper, I can't think who else did races 3 to 4 weeks, Ironman races 3 to 4 weeks before Kona this year. And I remember chatting with somebody and thinking and those guys performed quite well. I'm wondering whether the fact that they'd done that big race that was almost like a big training day out for them, and then that forced them to recover a bit earlier, meant they actually came into the World Championships a little bit undercooked. And I've heard, Sebastian Keenley particularly has spoken about this, saying it's better to be a little undercooked coming into the big race rather than overdone.
I agree.
Is that something you've tried?
So the first year I tried that was 5 years ago or so, when one of the years I raced Kona, and it was the first time I actually thought about racing back to back. So I chose Arizona, and I had no idea what was going to happen. I said, "Well, look, have a clear mind, go to Arizona, try and re-qualify, and see how it goes. I may blow up, I may not blow up." And just going back, I didn't know how long it would take me to recover. I actually got back to fitness and feeling fresh enough quite quickly, which I continue to do to this day. I went to Arizona and I raced very well, set a PB and won my age group. And I think that just gave me the confidence to know, okay, well, I do have the ability to recover very quickly. And the race went very well. Not racing as fit, no fancy numbers on the board, but I just believe I'm very battle hardened at that stage.
How in terms of your Kona fitness level, how much fitness do you think you were you'd lost by the time you raced in Cozumel?
Quite a bit. In terms of how I felt a lot fresher. I felt a lot fitter. But if you were to go by the numbers, I was quite a bit not very unfit, but I certainly was nowhere near Kona numbers. Nowhere near them.
I mean, there's a couple of things there, but I think the key one is, confidence in your fitness. I think that people have been training for a number of years, have a certain level of residual fitness all the time, and taking a couple of weeks off to get over a big race dents the fitness a little bit, but they've always got that base fitness and that experience as well, which counts for a lot. And the second thing there is the confidence, which gives you the knowledge that you can come into a race, and actually sometimes the numbers don't predict what performance you're going to put in. I mean, you've just mentioned there that in the space of 6 weeks, you went to one race with great numbers and didn't perform because of something. And you went to another race where the numbers were less and, you know, did perform. So it's not always about the numbers. And yet for the majority of people who might be listening to this, their key focus is on, if my numbers are down before a race, that means my performance is going to be lower.
No, I completely disagree with that. I suppose I'm the proof in the pudding, and I'm sure there are lots and lots of other age group athletes, because even this last 2 to 3 years, the first year I went to Arizona, there wasn't so many people on that start line that had raced Kona in my age group. And the preceding 3 to 4 years, when I did race Arizona, everybody who was in my age group and winning and on the podium, we had all raced Kona. And in Cozumel, it's the same. So people are are following the same thing. You know, we're all fit. We may not have the same numbers, but most of us are at the top end of stuff, can carry it through.
You've qualified for Kona, you know, 10 times now, or is this going to be the 11th one now?
Yeah, 2020 will be my 11th year. 11th year, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, and you quite often win your age group in these qualifying races. Do you, because of that confidence and knowledge, are you able to turn up to those races less fit so that you can peak later on and still know that you're going there? Or do you still have that trepidation like your first time of, will it be enough?
No, often I get the comment after Kona, well, only you're racing again to go and get your Kona slot. And I look at people and I go, well, I'm going to try and get my Kona slot. Never once do I ever take it for granted that I'm going to go to Arizona or Cozumel, and it's a foregone conclusion that I know I'm fit, I know I'm strong, I know I have experience. I need to race. I need to have a strong mind, a strong body. And no, it's difficult. It's very, very difficult. But people just may not see that. But it's not easy.
I mean, 11 times now in 11 years, we talked about not being a professional athlete, but some people will be looking at you saying it's almost the way you set your life up is almost like a professional athlete. Yeah. You know, you go to Kona, then get qualified early, and then you focus. What is it that drives you to keep going back there then? Because there's so much else out in the world that I'm sure you'd appreciate. And, you know, because you seem like a person who appreciates the surroundings you're in and the locations you go to.
Yeah, again, you know that, and you even hear it's a very strange and funny place, Kona, and you know, number one, it's extremely difficult to get there. If you have to qualify to get to Kona, it's not easy. No one gives you a free slot. You have to race against the best, and when you do get to Kona and you're on the start line, the people who in your age group, and well, the age group is all I'm concerned about, you know that 90% of those are the best in the world. And so I get a chance to walk around town before the race. I get a chance to race against those guys and see where I am. So for me, the challenge is never stopping, because I don't want to go to a race and I don't want to go, okay, I know I'm going to win this. I want to go and go, Jesus, will I even finish? Or I want to beat this guy. I want to beat that guy, because I know they want to beat me and they know who I am and I know who they are. And it's a challenge, you know? So I think if or when it ever happens where it doesn't excite Nick anymore, I'll pull the pin easily. But for now, I enjoy the process of, will I qualify? And then when I do qualify, okay, what can I do? I want to win. I want to come as high up my age group as possible. And I set targets. It's not that I just go to Kona, okay, just turn up and race. I want to race well. And when I don't race well, I don't put my hands on my head and feel sorry for myself.
Have you won your age group in Kona?
No, never.
So I guess that's something you're still chasing then.
Yes, it's highly unlikely to happen.
What's the best position you've had?
I think 11th or 12th, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So you've never had a top five there, never been at the awards ceremony on the podium with the Amici Bowl?
No, never did. And again, it's fair to the last couple of years. And the reason why I said almost immediately there to your answer, no, I've never been on the podium, and I probably never will, because with the last 2 to 3 years, I've become a little bit disillusioned with Ironman and who they let race and stuff like that there. But
who's in your age group then? Is Vinokourov in your age group?
Vinokourov won my age group this year, so
he's got history he's a professional athlete at the very highest level, but we all know about his other history, you know, the drugs and the drug bans and everything else, and there seems to be no shame on his behalf. I went and stood right at the front of the award ceremony when he came on to see what the response was, and I understand that response was the same when he won his title in Nice at the 70.3. Yeah. As an athlete there, what are your thoughts about, you know, them letting drug cheats back in? Because if I take the opposing view, he served his time and there's nothing to stop him racing. And I guess that's what Iron Man will say. But we all know that there's a hangover from taking drugs, isn't there? You know, you never fully clears your system and you lose all those benefits.
Look, Ironman for me has, certainly this last while, or have very much double standards. You know, they try and promote I Am True, the anti-doping stuff, whatever it was. Yes, they allow cheats like Vinokourov, and even in the age group up from me, Lauren Jalbert, and there's just so many. There's so many names that I can't remember, but like we can list all past convicted drug cheats. And so Ironman, you know, they should take a stance on it and go, those guys should not be able to race. It's as simple as that. And yes, they were convicted, they served their time in bits and pieces. But you know, and I know, and everybody knows that, first of all, Vinokourov in particular, was a pro cyclist for what, 10, 15, whatever years, whatever it was. He successfully evaded drugs detection for the vast majority of that. So you telling me that he goes to Kona, I'm not saying he is, by the way, but he doesn't know ways run to beat the testing. It gets me really mad talking about it, it gets me really disheartened, because even before I went to Kona this year on the tough days, when I busted my ass here on the 5, 6, 7 hour bikes and stuff like that in the wet, and I would come in and just say to my wife, and I just don't know why I'm doing this, because my target is to finish in the top five, and I know I won't finish in the top five, not because of my ability, but because of cheats, of potential cheats. And it really, really, really ticks me off, and it ticks me off of the double standards of Ironman, you know.
No, I can understand that. And I mean, you're the first person that we've had, on the show that's been in a position where they might be able to get a podium, but where that pathway's blocked by people who are helping themselves on the way with cheating, really. Yeah. So it's good. And I appreciate the fact that you've been very open about it. A lot of people might have said, I don't really want to talk about it, but that's how it is, and these are the things that we tend to talk about when we're training with our mates off record, aren't they? So thank you for sharing that one. I understand your frustration, because I think I'd probably be the same. Is what's the point, when you see people who are blatantly ignoring the rules?
Yeah, well, if I let stuff like that get to me, then I probably would never race ever again. No. So again, I just have to ignore those type of people. I know the vast majority of people know what happens, what goes on, and as long as I know my heart and my soul, I'm going, and I may not be able to achieve my goal of getting on that podium, but it's not the be all and end all.
Well, I think at the end of the day, Mr. Vinokourov and people like him, as we've said, they seem to have no shame. He's never apologized for what he did in cycling. He probably wouldn't stand it. He'd probably listen to all the boos and just shrug his shoulders. He wouldn't apologize for that. I think the main thing is that, you talked about the I Am True thing. Is can you stand up there and honestly say I Am True? Because if you resorted to their methods to get on the podium, you wouldn't be able to look at yourself in the mirror, and you wouldn't be able to look at your wife and children. And I think that's the thing for us personally is, am I true?
Yeah, but the thing about real, real proper cheats is that they don't care about that.
No.
I have no idea and how they can do that with their friends, patting them on the back and go, yeah, you won your age group or you're a champion. Mm. And I know I would walk in the bathroom and look at the mirror and go, you're a cheat. Mm. You're lying to everyone around you. Everybody who thinks you're a hero, you're just lying to them all. You're a cheat. You're a failure. This, look, that's just me. But obviously those guys who are serial cheats, it doesn't bother them. It doesn't bother them at all. So anyway.
I think the majority of people who are listening to this, if not all of them, Owen, would be on your side with that one. And, that's how it is. But you're right. I think we just got to keep doing what we do and look at ourselves in the mirror and look at our families and say, I'm doing the best I can the right way.
Exactly.
Let's go right back to the beginning then. How long have you been involved in triathlon? How did you get started?
I think my first triathlon was a sprint, a local sprint here beside me, and that was in 2000, and I think 2004, because I think my first Ironman was in 2005.
So you went up to the Ironman distance fairly quickly then, not straight in at the deep end like some people do now.
Yeah, again, the first sprint trial, I, number one, I didn't even own a bike. And I borrowed a wetsuit. It wasn't even a proper wetsuit. It was one of those short sleeve things that you wear when you go in the ski-doos.
Yeah.
And I did it, and it was I was hyperventilation mode from start to finish. And as soon as I crossed the finish line, I was addicted there and then. I just loved the challenge of it. I loved how it hurted. I loved how it felt when I crossed the finish line. And I think, I did. I signed up for an Ironman as soon as I could after that.
So that was in your early 30s. What was your sporting background before that first triathlon?
So I played football from quite a young age, Gaelic football. I played that from under 10 up to senior level. And then in my later years, I just done quite a bit of running. I never actually done any running races, but just to keep fit, I was running 5-6 days per week, mostly mountain running and stuff. But I never ran competitively.
Yeah, but you've got there's some comparisons there with some of the top performers in our sport, isn't there? Merinda Carfrae, I think, was she a basketball player? And Craig Alexander was a soccer player as well. Both of whom, but two of the athletes I think have got the best running techniques in the sport. You know, not, maybe I'd add Annie Haug to that list now. But when you look at just beautiful flowing techniques, those two guys, and it seems to me that athletes that have done those sports, because there's an awful lot of aerobic conditioning required for playing a sport like that, and the fact that you're doing a lot of lateral running, a lot of backwards running, seems to build a robust body that withstands injury a little bit more. You know, you've got a range of running speeds, you're jogging around a lot, but you're sprinting. Compared to people who've been brought up with triathlon or running, where they tend to be much more one-paced, I think perhaps that team sports give you a very good foundation for moving into endurance sports later on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree 100%. Any sport is good sport. But I think if you do sport, no matter what it is, from an early age, it helps install competitiveness. And it's good. Even though you're a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old, it's good. You know, it's especially when you see kids nowadays who are stuck to their iPhones and iPads. Mm. It was better times.
What was your first Ironman then in 2005? Austria.
Yeah.
One of my favorite race venue now, although I'm going back to Penticton this year in Canada. I don't know if you ever raced there.
I did. I raced it. I actually raced Ironman Penticton on the last year. It's back to Ironman now, but the last year it stopped being Ironman and then went to Challenge again. Most definitely one of my favorite races.
Yeah. I did Canada 5 times, finished 4 of them. My favorite venue, very disappointed when they closed it down. Went to Austria. That became my new favorite venue. And it still is. But I'm really looking forward to going back to Penticton this year. That'll be 25 years since I did my first Ironman.
Penticton is I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the bike course. As you know, it's certainly not an easy bike course.
No.
And later on, when I'm possibly thinking of doing an Ultraman, that's where the Ultraman in Canada is based in Penticton. So
yep.
That's probably my choice for that race.
So Austria, great course. Those lovely silky roads, the short uphills, the long downhills, so you can just get in that ski position and glide, can't you? Like being a skier. There's no sharp corners, which means you don't lose any speed. That first 40K down by the lake, you feel like you're sort of a superhero, don't you? Because you can average 40 or 50K down there without any effort. Then you get that rude awakening with the first hill, although I know they've changed the course now. There's that amazing swim in the blue, the sort of bluey green lake, and the bit down the channel with all the spectators. It's just a fabulous place. But so, how was that first experience for you? Other than the beautiful course and the amazing spectators,
it was good. It was good. Again, it must have been good because I continue to do it year after year after year. I enjoyed it. Again, it's probably the closest I've came to death in a swim because I was completely inexperienced and I thought I was actually Michael Phelps for the first 200 meters and tried to beat everybody. I learned that lesson quite quickly, but you know, it was good. I was racing on a bike, an old track bike that it wasn't a triathlon bike at all, but it was makeshift. It was a 58 centimeter track bike with skinny wheels. It was, in hindsight now, it was just way, way, way too big for me.
Well, I was going to say, I don't recall, Owen, that you're much taller than me, and I ride a 54. So either you've got extremely long legs, or the saddle was on the top of the top tube, and it looked like one of those bikes that parents give to their kids when they want them to grow into it.
And that's exactly what I rode on.
Excellent. So, and in terms of your performance, then, where did you finish in your age group?
I don't know where I finished in my age group, but my first one was 11 hours 11 minutes.
Yeah. So what was your next one then? Because I'm interested in the progression and at what point you felt like you might have a shot at qualifying for Kona.
So the next one was Switzerland, which was a horrible race, simply because again I was so inexperienced and I tried to win the race from the minute one. It was extremely hot that day. Number three, I think, was Lanzarote. Number four was, I think, Frankfurt. And then, so the fourth one in Frankfurt, my time, I forget what my time was, but I realized that I may be standing the chance of being in a position to fight for Kona. And so from the fourth one onwards, my focus changed towards possibly qualifying for Kona.
So at that point then, after Frankfurt, when you thought I could have a chance for Kona, then what changes did you make in training and in your lifestyle in order to make that happen, and how long did it take?
Well, even from my first Ironman, you know, before I started doing Ironmans, you know, I was just a normal guy, beers the weekend, diet not really, really good. And from the first Ironman, I cut out alcohol completely. I did have a clean diet. I knew that you couldn't have a fat, pudgy guy starting, trying to be competitive on a start line. I didn't really change anything really when I was knew I had maybe the potential to qualify for Kona. I did change coaches at the time because my first Ironman, I had no coach. My second Ironman, I don't think I had a coach. On the third one, maybe I was working with, you know, the Mark Allen online thing. Mm-hmm. So I think I did that for 3 years. And then I changed coaches. And when I changed coaches, then on that, the year I went back to do Frankfurt, I qualified in the first time of attempting to qualify.
Who was your coach when you qualified then, first time?
Mark White.
Oh, Mark's based in England. Was he part of the training Bible thing?
Yeah, he was. So Rob Griffiths introduced me to Mark, and then
I know Rob quite well. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So I worked with Mark for I think 3 seasons, maybe 4.
Okay, so that clearly worked out quite well for you.
Yeah, it did. It did. But I think what people often forget was that the 3 and 4 years work I did before I qualified for Kona, I spent 3 years doing the exact same thing, the exact same heart rates, the exact same everything. And for me, those were probably three of the most important years in my whole triathlon career, because, you know, I just dug that big foundation of base aerobic capacity. And, you know, I built the engine. I had not really much speed, but even to this day, when I'm relatively, as I am now, relatively unfit, I can still run, I can still bike, and I can still swim pretty good. And that's all down to work I probably did 12 years ago.
Yeah, that whole thing about the foundation, Owen, I think it's so overlooked. You know, I mentioned that I'd spoken with Stephen Seiler, and he has this whole presentation. If you've never seen it, I'll share it with you because it's really good. It's about his hierarchy of training needs. It's from Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. And at the bottom, he's got 9 steps in this pyramid. At the bottom, it says, just do the training, frequency and volume, right? Don't worry about anything fancy. Just get the training in. Then if you're going to make a change, add some high intensity intervals occasionally. You know, you don't have to have any structure. Just do 1 a week, 2 a week. Don't do them every day. Then once you've started doing that, polarize your training bit. Make sure that 80 to 90% of what you do is below that aerobic threshold, and 10 to 20% is above that. But make sure there's lots of easy stuff. Right. Then you can start doing things like periodization, micro periodization. You can start adding in some of the technical stuff that you'd probably be familiar with now, like using power, going to altitude, working out in heat, you know, doing sleep low or fasted training. But all of those little nuances have really limited effect unless you've built that huge foundation first. And you've probably seen this as an athlete and a coach. I definitely see it as a coach. Is people are far too focused on the icing on the cake rather than making the cake itself. And that's another one of Seiler's phrases that he knows from Norway, is you've got to spend time making the cake before you can eat it. And it takes a lot longer to make a cake than it does to eat it.
Yeah, well, you took the words right out of my mouth there. People think that they start making the cake in at the start of January and it's ready to go at the end of January. Impossible. People, whenever I speak to people, think that all of a sudden I'm good enough, but no one's seen me all those years ago, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, just plugging away and plugging away and plugging away, being consistent day after day after day after day. And that's, for me, as I mentioned a few moments ago, was the most important part, probably, because I built 3 years worth then of solid foundation, solid base, knowledge for starters, and knowing that if you try to go too hard too soon, you will get injured, you will blow up, and it's as simple as that. And you and I and everybody listening to this is the exact same.
It's a long process, isn't it, getting to Kona? I mean, sport, you know, triathlon and particularly Ironman is a long day out. You know, nobody finishes an Ironman in 5 hours. Nobody will ever finish an Ironman in 5 hours. And so it's a long day out. You need patience just to pace yourself right over that particular day. And training to have the endurance to do that properly takes years and years and years. And I observe a lot of people who want to do stuff really quickly. They make the comment that they're willing to do anything, but then when you challenge them on, are you willing to do this for the next 10 years? You know, are you willing to just train easy for 3 years before we start doing the stuff that you might like to do? I was willing to do that. Yeah. I'm willing to do whatever it takes, but I'm not sure I'm willing to do that. But that's the important stuff that they're missing out on.
Yeah, I think that just always boils down to people like that thinking that there's a secret, that there's a shortcut. The only secret is that there's actually no shortcuts. And yeah, I agree that there are very few, very talented people out there who can go from year one and straight into it. Those guys are very few and far between. But for the most of us, we have to work at it. And people who know me personally would say, I don't really have a lot of patience, but in sport, there is simply no other way. You need to be patient, and nothing will certainly happen in your first season. You'll get fitter, you get stronger and stuff. Hopefully, if you have a proper coach, you'll gain knowledge and become more aware of what's needed to be done, especially if you're looking to qualify for Kona.
Mm. There's one guy that I know from the Isle of Man, qualified in his first or second Ironman at Ironman UK, managed to get through the swim, but this guy was almost a professional cyclist at the highest level. Used to train with Cavendish in Kenyuk in the Isle of Man. He also had run a 2:45 marathon, I think, standalone marathon. So he could swim, he could bike and run. And he battled his way back into contention on his first second Ironman qualified for Kona. I think he did a 9:30 in Kona. But he's one of the very few people. He's an outlier. He does not reflect the experiences of most people who, and most of the people I've worked with and know of that have qualified for Kona have had a pathway that that's like yours, 4 or 5 Ironman races, training over several years, being consistent, not getting injured so that they don't take a back step, a huge back step in their fitness, and attention to detail and to the process of training.
I agree. Again, if you go too hard too soon, you will get injured, you won't be consistent, and you won't get your goals. If you go slow and long, you reduce the chance of injury, you increase your chance of consistency, and as you said, when you're baking that cake, all the ingredients have to come together at the right time for you to be able to put the icing on the cake when it counts.
You mentioned your coach, you mentioned Mark White, and then I know you've been coached by Alan Cousins. It was Alan's post the other day about your consistency over the last few years that prompted me to get in touch. As we mentioned earlier, we've known each other for about the same amount of time as you've been going to Kona. What is it that Alan brings to the party, and how did you happen on Alan and choose him to be your coach?
So Martin Muldoon, a friend, Martin, he was getting coached by Alan. Martin introduced me to Alan. And when I was working with Mark, Mark didn't do anything wrong. It was just time for me to move on. And that was it. I wanted a new stimulus. I wanted to learn some more. And so that Martin introduced me to Alan and got to know him, and then realized what Alan was about. He's very science and data orientated. I love that type of stuff. For me, even to be as a coach, you can't learn everything from books. It's good to learn stuff from actual people. So that's why I chose him to be my coach at that particular time.
I've not met Alan, but I've read quite a few of his articles and followed his tweets that come out on Twitter. And he definitely strikes me as being that sciencey, geeky guy that's interested in data, looking into his tweets. But he also strikes me as a sort of person who has a little bit of empathy and an understanding of the athlete as well. So there are definitely coaches who have that science knowledge, but are unable to translate that into conversation that the athlete can understand. So it's just what they deliver is above the heads of most people. There's a few special coaches who have the science knowledge and are then able to translate that into language for the real world. Having not met Alan, would that be a good summary of how he works?
Well, in terms of the knowledge and the science, yes. But, I wouldn't be with Alan if, number one for me, with working to a coach, with a coach, the most important thing is that I need to know personally is, does my coach care? And the answer to that is yes. And that's why I'm with Alan. And every coach, without a doubt, I'm a coach myself, you're a coach. Every one of us have different approaches to athletes. You may not be right, I may not be right, he may not be right, that doesn't matter. There is no 100% set guaranteed rate way for success or victory, whatever it was. So different people, different attitudes, different personalities, and I think that's the importance of choosing the coach, isn't it? Going back to before Mark White coached me, Rob Griffiths, he put me in contact with another coach. I forget his last name, Mark, his name was, and I rang him up one day, and within 15 seconds of the conversation taking place, the guy didn't say anything wrong to me. He didn't insult me. He did nothing wrong in any shape or form. For 15 seconds was enough to tell me, I can't work with this guy. And I just got back to Rob and I said, no, Rob, can't work with him. And I couldn't even give Rob a reason why. It's just a feeling that you get. So you need to be comfortable with your coach, and I am comfortable with my coach. And again, from me being a coach, it's I take some of Alan's philosophies and then I add my own to it, and I'm not saying I'm right, I'm not saying anybody's right, but again, this is what I enjoy about the sport.
I'll share a little story with you about that whole instinct thing. I was once at a presentation delivered by the head of the pilot selection program for the RAF. And he said that when they'd reviewed data going back 5 to 10 years, which included initial assessments on the interviews that they'd done when people had come to join flight school, and those individual assessments that each interview panel member had written, plus the group conversations, and then they'd fast forwarded to the future to see which of them had gone on to be successful fighter pilots, which of them had gone on to be helicopter pilots, which of them hadn't made the grade. Their success rate of choosing the right people based on their initial thoughts 10 years ago was 95% correct. So the instinct that they had using their experience enabled them to make a decision, I don't think this guy is going to be right. Much in the same way you've just mentioned about those first 15 seconds of that conversation, I don't think this guy's going to make it. Yes, this guy's got absolutely what we want for it to be a Top Gun fighter pilot. And I probably go along with what you've said there. Instinct's a fabulous thing. And yes, we do need to apply some other metrics to that to be sure that we're making the right decision. But I've taught courses where coaches have been through where I have absolutely from the first moment thought this guy's going to be a great coach, and years later I've bumped into them and they're doing really well, they're occupying a decent position, they're running a training academy, you know, they've just gone on to be just extremely good coaches. And then other people have come across my radar who I wasn't comfortable with at the time, and I've heard stories from other people in the sport, and you know, it's a very small sport, isn't it, so word gets around, and those stories that I've heard have confirmed my initial thoughts that I'm not sure how this guy's going to work out as a coach.
Yeah, I think and even as a coach, you know, when you meet an athlete, and those type of athletes who you were mentioning a while ago, they who are, yeah, I'll do whatever it takes. I think as a coach, you can speak to these type of athletes, and within that 10 seconds, you can listen and go, no, you won't. Because you just know they won't. Like there and then, for me, it's very easy to identify who will and who won't by a 15 to 20 second conversation. And again, that's just, I'm not saying I'm right, but it's just a perfect example of how every coach is different. And yeah, so there's no special sauce, as they say. It's just life experience.
Well, it probably indicates as well that one skill that coaches need to have is an ability to say no. It's very difficult, as you'll be aware, when you're starting off as a coach, to say no, because you want to build up the roster of athletes you're working with. If you're doing this as a business, you don't want to say no to somebody. You don't want to say I'm only going to work with athletes like this, or I don't feel like you're the person that's aligned with my beliefs and philosophies. But you very quickly come to the realization with an athlete, if you've taken on the wrong one, that you've made a mistake, and then you spend the next few months wondering how you can get out of it. And you learn over time, don't you, that actually saying no is often the best policy.
I agree. And again, in terms of if you are an athlete choosing a coach, the same thing applies. You know, you have to be very careful in your selection. So, yeah, well, that's life.
I wrote down there that Alan cares. One of the things I like to do is act a bit more like a life coach and take into consideration family life for people, the stresses and strains they might have from work, understanding their work, and that there's times in the year when, you know, things are going to be busy, like in your club there, you know, there's times when more people are going to come in, more less people are going to come in. So that's going to add to your stress. Family life and, you know, children going to school, children going to university, different things like that. Does Alan sort of take an interest in your family life and your life outside of training? And does he take that into account when he's setting your training, or does he just say, right, this is what you need to do, so you sort it out, Owen?
No, it's very flexible. And again, I think that comes down to my feedback to him. Again, if I was given no feedback at all, you know, felt good, felt bad in general, couldn't do this today, I had work and stuff. All that stuff is down to me. And if I can relate that to my coach and athletes who I work with, if they can relate that to me, then things are very easily adjustable. Yeah, it's just down to the athlete, I think. You know, an athlete definitely has to bear some of the responsibility for the coach's decisions, I think, because a coach is not a, for me anyway, is not a mind reader. He definitely does.
Yeah, I mean, if he knew, say that there was a lot of stress at home, let's say that there was a family member that was ill, would he be planning in a lower volume of training to give you a bit of breathing space to cope with that? Or would he just say, look, here's what I need you to do, Owen, but you're going to have to make a decision on a daily basis whether you think that your time needs to be spent caring for your family members or spending more time asleep to cope with the extra stress?
Yeah, well, sleep for me isn't a difficulty. I'm a master at that. But yes, I agree. So every morning I have a very set routine. I have to get up and I do my heart rate variability test. And when I do my heart rate variability test, I have to log into Alan's page. And there are a sort of mini questionnaire I have to fill in every morning. And that takes into consideration my rest and heart rate, my heart rate variability. And I think there's 5 or 6 or 7 questions, simple stuff that I have to answer. How do you sleep? How many hours did you sleep? So on and so forth. And then he obviously sees that. And then if there's a consistency in, oh, I'm too tired, then things will change. And that is, so again, that's going all down. Does your coach see or does your coach listen and does the coach react? And yes, he does. And that for me is very important and is what I try to get across with my own athletes as well. But again, at that cannot be done without a coach and athlete talking to each other via text, via email, via whatever it happens to be. Because at that, the coach is not a mind reader.
I'm interested in the fact that he requires you to complete that data on a daily basis. Now, I know that without that, he can't do his job properly. As you've just shared there, you need to be providing him with the data so he can assess that and intervene if necessary and say, hey, your heart rate variability looks a bit suppressed, though, and I'm wondering, you know, how valuable training is going to be at the moment. Maybe we just need a period of easy stuff, or is there some other stuff going on in your life that's causing this that we need to take account of? But equally, that does require some discipline from you. And one of the things that I've observed, and as I mentioned previously, working with athletes that I've helped to achieve their Kona goal, is that there's a difference between people who qualify for Kona. I would call them elite age groupers. You know, you get into the world championships, it's the top 2 or 3% these days of people who are taking part in Ironman events. There are certain traits that I've observed that you've mentioned, you know, in comments passing, and one of them is not just a willingness to do the work, it's a willingness to communicate regularly, to fill in the data, to fill in their training peaks diaries, to get all the data up there, to back up those heart rate graphs with some subjective comments like, okay, so I've done a 10K run today and I did a 10K run last week. I can't just say I felt good today and I can't just rely on my data being giving the full picture, because today I might have felt awesome and last week it might have been a complete slog. It's important to identify what the differences are. Maybe you've been working long hours, maybe you lost focus. When people are on it and motivated, they get that stuff done regularly. When people lose motivation, you notice that those comments don't come in. They don't fill the training peaks diary in quickly. They maybe miss a couple of days where they log into the coach's page and fill in the data. That, from a coach's perspective, that's as significant as a measure of somebody's eye on the ball.
Yeah.
As it is for them just to be doing the training, and those are the traits: doing the little things every day, having the discipline to do it every day. And that's when we talk about what are they willing to do. Are you willing to do this? Are you willing to get into a routine that won't be disturbed, where you get up every morning and the first thing you do is do this, not go and say good morning to your children, but do this first.
Yeah. I think it all goes back to the coach-athlete relationship. You know, you have, as I mentioned to you, these people are easy to spot. And I coached a person a good few years back, and training was done day in and day out. And I was given this session and whatever sessions, and the person had the potential to qualify for Kona. And it was only by chance one day I went to a physio, and the physio said to me, oh, such and such has a, I forget what it was, a knee problem or a calf problem. I said, no, not that I'm aware of. And no, it's fairly bad. And I got really upset. I got really mad. And I contacted the person. He didn't tell me you had a, I forget what was wrong at the time. Oh, no, it's okay. I can just keep on doing. But there I was giving speed sets and threshold runs and hill reps and whatever stuff that they were getting, whatever it is. And that person, you know, probably put their training back 2 years by not making comments in the boxes and letting me do my job and advising, okay, well, let's just not do this for a while now. Let's get this injury recovered. And again, look, there's so many different athletes out there with so many different personality traits, and it's an endless conversation, I suppose.
It is, but again, if you selected, you know, you went to an Ironman and you took the podium winners or you took the podium people, or you went to Kona and just selected 50 people at random and asked them for a quick snapshot of how they live their life, you'd find that there was a remarkable number of similarities between those people. And if you took the other 95% of people who take part in Ironman and maybe the 20% who think they've got a shot at Ironman, you'd see a lot of things that they're not doing that they need to do in order to qualify. And it wouldn't be down to the training. It's the other stuff that enables the training to have the right effect.
Okay. As individuals, we all can train and get our bodies in fantastic shape and have the potential to stay qualified at Kona. But just exactly what you're saying. So I've been at Kona 10 times now. This year will be my 11th. And at that, the majority of people who I see, who I know I've raced with over the years, it's just I speak to some of them and I look at them and go, they're nuts. And then I'm thinking, do you know what? I sometimes feel in conversation with them, I'm going, I just feel as if I'm speaking to myself here. Mm-hmm. The traits and the personalities and the just little comments is made here and there. And I'm going, but that little bit of madness or stuff is exactly what it takes. Madness is not the right word today, but that bit of driven personalities, focused, not overly stressed. I need to train. You know, like even myself now, I have the full confidence in myself. It was after I'd done Cozumel, I came home and yes, I had to continue doing the work in the studio, but that's say a 1 hour session or 2 hour session per day. So training was very unstructured, little swimming, little running and stuff. Put on the usual Christmas weight and stuff. Look, I have full confidence in myself. Now I'm unfit. Now I'm overweight compared to Conan's weight. I'm in full confidence that will change. My diet's back to normal. My training's back to normal in 4 weeks' time. And I'll be race fit, no shit. But I'll be back in a routine that is going to get me a race fit. And I'll continue that in February and March and April, May, June, July.
And I think that is another indication there, this consistency. You might back off, you know, foot off the gas a little bit, but it never goes fully off the gas. You don't swing between party mode, gaining weight, and then back into full-on training. So it's not an all-or-nothing approach. It's actually, you could probably draw two lines across a page, the top and the bottom, and there'd be a very shallow wave that goes underneath it that indicates your fitness. You know, you get up to peak fitness, you drop a little bit, but it would always be within that wave without the massive fluctuations. And it's, again, another thing that we haven't, perhaps the word they haven't mentioned that comes up so often is consistency. It's a consistency, not just in training, but just in lifestyle approach that enables you to have the environment that gets you to where you want to be.
Especially if you have the potential, or even if you have qualified for Kona and you're trying to get back to Kona, consistency is the very, very, very most important thing. Without doubt. It's what I see in other athletes who I race with and race against. Again, it's just consistency. And especially at the level of age group racing now in Kona, as you mentioned there a while ago, you know, most of the people who consistently qualify and re-qualify for Kona, yes, there's no doubt about it. There's a cutoff point where the age group goes into elite age group. And where that differs is the people are consistent in the training. Mm.
Can you outline a typical training week for us and maybe sort of indicate how it might change throughout the year?
It's again, with the work in the studio and stuff, I have to be pretty flexible. So I know what sessions I have to do every week. You know, I have a set of bikes I need to do and I get my stuff weekly, and I have quite often I have to completely rejig that run to suit myself, to suit when I work in the studio and stuff. In terms of hours, you know, it's we can only do what we've time to do. I'm in a very extremely lucky position that my work allows me to do 8 to 9 hours of biking per week. That's a part of my work. So not many people can do that. So I'm in a fortunate position in that way where I'm going to work every day and I'm putting on a cycling kit. And then, you know, so when I have my work done, where my studio is based, in the summertime, I have a lake 2K away. I have quite safe roads to run from and stuff. So I'm quite lucky and blessed that way. But, you know, I've raced with and competed with guys who had 9 to 5 jobs in the stock exchange in London and still go through 25 hours a week of training. They knew if they didn't do that 20, 25 hours a week of training, their chances of getting to Kona was slim.
What are you averaging roughly each week?
Probably an easy week for me would be 17 to 19 hours. And then it probably on peak weeks, say a camp week or something like that, it can be 32, 34 hours.
Take any rest days?
I don't take any days off in particular, but I have plenty. I have lots of easy ride days. You know, I could ride my bike. Yesterday, I rode my bike for 3 hours. Easy at a 120 heart rate. I was, you know, as I call it, a look over the ditch ride. And it was, you know, fun riding the bike, no stress. I didn't really have to look at heart rate, just ride the bike. And yes, it was training, but very, very little stress in the body. Very, very good mentally. Free the mind, refresh the body, and everything. And, you know, so no off days, not unless I get sick or something like that, but no.
Stephen Seiler talks about staying under the stress radar. You know, a session like that, 3 hours at a heart rate of 120, it's still going to give you a fair amount of TSS points. There's still going to be some aerobic benefit, but in terms of recovery, somebody like you who's extremely well conditioned, you won't notice it the day after.
Well, today I do notice it but my only reason is because now I'm probably as unfit as I will be all year. You know, I took the bit of downtime over Christmas. I don't drink at all during the year, and my diet is extremely good and extremely clean all year. But I do have a few beers around Christmas. I do open the box of roses. I have an absolutely normal human being life. And I think that's a thing that most people don't see with me. People who are local, who see me regularly, can see that. They can see I'm a normal person. At Christmas time, I enjoy a couple of beers, as I said, the food and the stuff and bits and pieces. But people away on social media, they must think I'm in a cave training 30 hours per week doing mad stuff. But I'm not. One thing that I just actually put up on Facebook last week to prove to people who are trying to qualify for Kona, look, you just have to be an ordinary person. So my plan is now, starting from maybe next week, is just to do an Instagram video to show people, look, I'm normal here. I've put on weight over Christmas. I'm not fit now. A 3-hour bike, which would normally not even have take any taxation out of me, I'm not tired today. But, you know, my legs are a little bit stingy and stuff. I'm normal. I am not in freak-out mode because I've done a 3-hour bike and I feel it's a part of the process.
Well, at the end, Owen, I'll get the link for that. We'll share that with people so they can follow you and see what your journey's like and get a real true picture. Over the years, how has your training changed then as you've gained experience and understand more about what you need to do and what you don't need to do?
Training really hasn't changed a lot. You know, going back to the Mark Allen days, I done the same program, the same workouts, the same heart rate, the same everything for 3 years in a row. The first year, it was all new to me. I thought it was just the best thing since sliced bread. Year two, I was a bit surprised. Mid-year, I go, geez, this is the same stuff again. And I continued doing it. And then I said, no, I'm definitely going to change on year three. But me being me, I signed up again. And it was the same stuff. Heart rates were slightly changed because I was getting older. But I did it. And again, I had faith in what I was doing. I could see I was improving. And then when I changed, went to Mark then, again, the training structure was a little bit different. There was a little bit more variation in sessions and stuff like that. But again, the sessions were different, but the principles were almost the same. And in terms of now with Alan, again, yes, sessions are different, but it's still coming back down to, you know, be patient at the start. You or I or everybody listening to this needs to know that they will not build a huge aerobic base in a year. Yes, they will get better, they will get stronger. But in terms of being a Kona qualifier or a repeat Kona qualifier, it doesn't happen overnight. It's a long process.
I think that you'd have to follow a fairly polarized approach with a lot of relatively easy training, wouldn't you, in order to be able to get 17 to 20 hours in on a regular basis, given that you're not a full-time athlete, you've got work to do and you've got family as well.
I think Alan put up a tweet there one day last week that somebody replied to the tweet and he said, well, my average heart rate for all of my sessions last year was 130. So the top end of my zone one is 135. So that says it all. You know, you speak to athletes now and they're already talking about speed sessions and add more speed and more power. And I'd be looking going, why would you want to do all that? You do not have the engine to do that.
No, I agree. And I mean, I see the value in doing some small amounts of it at the top end, but you know, small amounts, just build the engine now. And I don't know if you ever come across Dion Harrison. I'm sure you and Dion would have been in Kona at the same time. Dion, you hang around with people like Stuart Anderson and Declan Doyle and Tim Bishop. You know,
I'm friends with Stuart and Declan and all them guys.
Dion spent a bit of time in Boulder, and I remember him telling me stories about Craig Alexander that was riding out there, and they'd be climbing up one of the hills and Craig would be off the back and then he'd turn around and he'd go, that's me, done for the day, guys. You know, no ego, just sticking to his heart rate. Maffetone tells the same story about Mark Allen, you know, getting dropped off the back, sticking to his heart rate, being the last one up to the top, you know, everybody's waiting for him at the cafe. But come the summer, when it really mattered, he was the one who was dropping everybody else because he had that intensity discipline when it mattered.
I'll tell you a story that has happened to me this last 3 to 4 years. So in run, I'm back into a structured running. And on the same run this last 3 years has happened on a Sunday morning. I've actually met the same guy on the same day at the same time. And I'm running at my prescribed heart rate, which probably could be 8 minute mile pace, 8 minute 15 pace, very, very slow for me. And he passes me every single year. So he does at the same time. And every single year I said to him, I'll see you in 4 months' time. And the same thing happens. I run past him in zone one, running a 7:15 pace, and he's huffing and puffing to keep up then. So he is. Yet I'm still in the aerobic zone. So, you know, I have confidence in what I'm going to do. Am I running slow now? Yes. Am I biking slow now? Yes. Will I be doing that in 6 months' time? No.
I keep referring to the Siler podcast, but he had so much great information. So listeners, if you haven't been to listen to that podcast yet, it was last week's episode. Please do go back and listen. It's a long one, but there's so much valuable information in there. Siler talks about the Ethiopians and how they run. For most of the year, they run on internal metrics. So they do it by feel. They run very, very hard when they have to. They run very, very easy. They're not really bothered about what speed they're running. So they're not worried about pace. They don't use those little Strid monitors. They don't wear a GPS. I've got to speed up. I've got to slow down. They just think, well, my breathing's nice and easy. We're chatting. That's fine because this is a long run, or this is an interval session and I need to be feeling like, you know, death. And that's what today is. But once they get close to a race, they start focusing more on the pace that's required to be comfortable to race that marathon. So they have some very set times. They'll run, you know, 10 to 15 seconds slower than race pace for intervals. And then they'll run 30 at 80% of that pace for their recovery intervals. And they'll extend the duration of those intervals within a set distance of session. So internal metrics most of the year, pace for 8 to 10 weeks before the event, but that's what enables them to have that upwards trajectory that you're talking about in fitness.
And no
ego. Park the ego before you go out. Leave it. Nobody gives a shit what you're doing, you know, and how good you are now. But what really matters is what happens to you on race day, and that's the way that you'll do it, is by parking that ego and just listening to your internal clock.
Well, like you said, again, all of the guys who I know who are repeat Kona offenders, you know, all show that trait. And, you know, now we don't care. We're not too upset about carrying that little bit of weight. Now we don't care if we bike slow or run slow and stuff. But they all know, and I all know, that when the business is to be done, it'll be done.
One final thing, Owen, because I've kept you on the line for a while now. We talked about you going back to Kona regularly. We talked about your performance there. I also mentioned that there's a lot more out in the world than the triathlon world there. If you get to that point where you decided that you're done with Kona, what are the other things that interest you to do in the triathlon or multi-sport world?
So two things I've mentioned before are huge on my bucket list, and I'm really going to have to do them soon. The Ultraman. So again, it's something I actually plan to do one this year, but then I went and qualified in Cozumel. So potentially in 2021 will probably be my first Ultraman. And if I could get a team together, a four-man team together, to do the Ram race across America. I have three guys in mind, and you know, if I thought I could get enough sponsorship and money together, it's something I would love to go and do and win, because the guys I would have picked, I'm going to win it. I'm just not going to do it. Or we will be going to win it. I'm not going to do it. So yeah. So the Ultra Ironman, with the view of racing Kona in the World Championships ultra distance, because as mentioned, getting a little bit disillusioned with the Ironman racing in Kona at the moment. I love it. Don't get me wrong. It's so special to be there. It's such a lovely place to be. I feel proud. I feel happy. But you can. I think, you know, there's no point in going anymore just for the sake of going. I want to go and be competitive, and I know I'm not going to really be competitive, not through my own fault, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation. So I believe I can go to the Ultraman distance. I don't believe I'm particularly fast. I just believe I can just go for a long time at a good, decent pace. And so going up a distance would probably suit me. And you know, I'm getting older. I'm 47 last week. And I'm not going to continue doing it for life. So I want to challenge myself. Ultraman will without a doubt challenge me. And the Ram will without doubt challenge me if I can get doing the Ram.
Yeah, I've always been interested in Ultraman. I went to watch some friends take part in the Ultraman that they've got running in Wales now. That was really interesting. The Ultraman in Kona, I don't know if you've ever, in your trips to the island, have ever had a chance to ride up past the volcano and onto the other side of the island and up from Hilo. And, you know, those are just long drags. They go on and on and on, 5 or 6%. But, you know, you're climbing from sea level up to maybe 2,500 meters in one go. That heat. Yeah.
That's the challenge, you know. Yeah. You know, if you said to me, "Oh, it'll be easy," then I would definitely wouldn't do it. Again, I can even, well, every Ironman's the same, but certainly Ultraman, I would know I'd be starting that race going, "Jesus, will I even finish this?" But I would train, I would prepare accordingly, and you know, I'd just go and give it a something that excites me. Kona still excites me. It's getting a little bit difficult to accept when you know you're not getting really what you deserve out of the race.
I remember riding back from Harvey back down into Kona and thinking, oh, this is the run that they do on the Ultraman all this way. Man, it's a long way on a bike. I just, in my mind at the moment, I couldn't ever fathom running down that bit, particularly when you've turned back onto the highway, that long, boring stretch through the lava where there's no vegetation, there's no shelter. It's just a straight line as you run along towards Waikoloa and up towards the veteran cemetery. Yeah, that would definitely be a mental struggle, that bit.
It's peaks and troughs, because you know, when I was running in the energy lab last year, and we were lucky with the weather last year in Kona, it wasn't that hot. Well, no, it's not that it wasn't that hot. We actually got quite a bit of cloud cover for the run, and so the energy lab was actually nowhere near as bad as what it does be in normal years. My thoughts were, during the Ironman race, I'm never doing the Ultraman. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I know maybe it wasn't that bad. So, you know, just stuff changes. So I am going to do it. But when?
Well, I'll be interested to watch your journey on that one. I mean, you've definitely got the mindset for it and that base fitness. So, yeah, it'd probably be a good step up for you. Equally with the Rams. I appreciate you sharing all of this with us today, Owen. It's been great to get an insight into the mind of a Kona qualifier is quite special. And you've sort of confirmed what I always thought about people who qualify for Kona. There's some basic personality traits and behavior patterns that they all seem to share. And, you know, as I say, you've sort of echoed that really today. So thanks very much for coming on, spending some time sharing that with us. Good luck in Kona next year. I look forward to seeing you out there again. And yeah, please do share with me once we're off air that link to your Instagram channel, and we will share that with people so they can follow that weekly Instagram video. It'd be interesting to see how you get on there. You're certainly articulate, and with your Irish accent there, I know everybody loves to listen to an Irishman chat, so I should imagine that would be quite popular.
Okay, no worries at all, Simon.
Appreciate it, Owen. Take care. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Okay, Simon. Thanks for having me, and I'll chat to you soon.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.